For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits.
Well, that's okay. We'll make it right.
Don Mazzella here again for Small Business Digest. And we're going to deviate a little bit from our usual guests. We have a woman who's here to talk about our health. And I thought her message was so important. I said, you come on the show and talk about it. Georgiana Donadio, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, as we ask all, I guess, first we start out with the question, who are you? Well, give us a little bit of your background.
Okay. I've been a medical professional and I've been a medical educator for the last, 60 years. It's been a long time. And I currently am the program director of the National Institute of Whole Health. And I do a lot of work in terms of education. I'm still working to help educate people about what I consider to be really important things.
Well, what are those important things?
Well, that's what I'm on the show to talk about today, Don, is I think one of the biggest things, and I hear this all the time, and I see this all the time, is that today, as opposed to 50 years ago, 60 years ago, people are going for care and for help to their medical doctors and to their medical practices. And they're coming out in many cases a lot worse off than they went in. Okay. I mean, it's become quite an issue. As a matter of fact, there was an article, I'm sure most people, you know, are familiar with the news and they know who Jake Tapper is. He's a pretty well-known, he's on CNN and he's a very well-known reporter. And his young daughter went into the hospital and nearly died because of misdiagnosis. And this is a very, very, very common problem today. People are getting the wrong drugs. They're getting the wrong diagnosis. They're getting the wrong treatment. So many things are going wrong that right now, medical error is considered the third leading cause of death. And on my website, there's a lot of articles that support and discuss that whole problem.
Well, let's stop there. What's your website?
The website is www.wholehealtheducation.com.
Okay.
So they can go see that. They can read all the articles they're all from medical journals and medical websites. We're dealing with an epidemic of error today. Doctors are distracted. Nurses are overwhelmed. They're not focusing on what they're doing a lot of the times. And a lot of the times they're getting things wrong. And as a result, who suffers from that? Who suffers from when things go wrong? Certainly not the health professional, okay?
The patient. If it goes wrong, doctor doesn't die, the patient dies.
That's right. That's right. I'm sorry to say, but there are a lot of medical deaths that are occurring as a result of, I'll give you for instance, people who are, you know, dealing with treating cancer, the drugs, the chemotherapy, very often it's overprescribed or it's not properly prescribed or they're not being monitored or watched carefully. And many people will die from the treatment before they die of the disease.
That's scary. So
it really is.
How did you come to identify this problem and to come to the conclusion that you did?
Well, this isn't my conclusion. I've been in the field for decades, and I've been treating people and seeing people for decades, and I've heard so many stories. And as of late, within the last 5 to 10 years, those stories are increasing. And I said, you know, I gotta look this up because I like to do research. I'm an educator, so I like to do research. So I did some research and I said, what's going on? Why are there so many problems that are coming out of medical care? And I looked at the studies and I looked at the research, and it's very clear that the errors, the medical errors, are rapidly increasing. And I mean, you've got things where people have the wrong limb cut off, or the wrong organ is taken out, or they get the wrong medication, or they're diagnosed incorrectly. They're being treated for the wrong thing. This is a very common occurrence. And I bet if you spoke to people like I do all the time about it, you'd find out just how common and commonplace it is. So, but it's something what I like to talk to people about is not just that, but how can you become your best advocate for yourself? How can you become the best advocate for yourself? How can you go into healthcare, go into surgery or whatever, and know that you have really done your best effort to protect you from these errors? That's what I think is really the message that I'm trying to deliver.
Well, how can you? Now, having said that, you postulated the problem. Now, how do you solve it?
Right. Well, one of the things that we've done with our website is we give away a free kind of text or a guide for people to understand advocacy, to understand what is it, how do you do it, what do you need to know, how do you need to approach the whole idea of working with your doctor, but also looking out for yourself. I mean, there are very important things. Most people, Don, when they go into a meeting or an appointment with their doctor, they turn the whole thing over to that person. They're not necessarily, having researched or looked at or looked up or understood what it is that they're bringing into the doctor. Whatever your condition is, you should be very well, very well versed in it. You should know the ins and outs. You should know all the questions that you need to ask. And one of the biggest things, I'll tell you, I worked as an advocate the last few years of my practice. And as it happened, the people that I was serving were mostly male patients who were going in for surgery. I don't know why, but that's how it turned out. And I could literally go with them to their doctor's appointment, go with them to their surgical appointment, and walk with them right up to the operating room, and then say goodbye and wish them luck, okay? And they all said the same thing. When their doctor, when their team knew that they had a medical advocate working with them on their particular situation, everything changed. The doctor was more alert. The doctor was paying attention. The doctor was giving them better responses. And I think the reason is very simple. If you're a medical professional and somebody is working with an advocate, you've got more eyes on you. Now you've got people that are watching and listening and taking notice of what you're doing. One of the things you'll find this quite amusing, I know I did when I heard this, the advice is never have surgery on Monday or Friday. The biggest problems with error and confusion occur on Mondays and Fridays. And why do you think that is?
Shift changing, and people aren't there. They aren't in a regular place, Mondays
Well,
and Fridays.
it's really simple. The doctors and the nurses, they're either going away for the weekend and they're distracted, or they're coming back and they're distracted. The best time to get somebody's focus is not at the beginning or the end of time off. So one of the things, and this has helped a lot of people I know, when you say to people, your best bet is to go in on a Wednesday or a Tuesday or a Thursday and make sure that you have your doctor's or your nurse their staff, make sure you have their attention. You really want to make sure. And a lot of times I advise people, you want to have your questions. The biggest thing you can do as a consumer, when you go to buy a car, what do? When you go to buy a house, what do?
You ask questions.
I can tell you that more people will go in for surgery. I mean serious surgery. They'll take all kinds of drugs and medication. They won't ask the same kinds of questions that they will ask when it comes to their money. When it comes to spending their money, when it comes to paying for the house or the car or whatever it is they're buying, they will be very well versed. They'll do the research. They'll know what to ask. They'll really understand what's going on. But they're going in. There are people that go in for, all kinds of cardiac surgery, all kinds of, different procedures. A lot of times, if you go in for surgery and your body has not been assisted to make sure it doesn't, throw a clot after your surgery, you can be in a lot of trouble. Okay. People don't ask, they don't look it up, they don't research, they don't talk to people and say, I'm 75. First of all, anybody over 65 who has surgery, they're taking a big risk. And that's a fact. You can look it up. It's a big risk to have surgery after 65. They're sending 70-year-old, 80-year-old, my ex-mother-in-law, she was 90, and they put her in for surgery. I mean, why? Doesn't anybody stop and say to their doctor, look, I've read that it's not a good idea for me to be in surgery at this age, that my chances of dying within the first year after surgery is tremendously elevated at my age. People after a certain age have a much greater risk of dying 6 months, 8 months, a year after surgery. And unless you're really interested in saving your own skin, you don't look into this stuff. You don't look up this stuff. And this is my passion is saying to people, look, this is your life. Okay. You've only got one of them. This is your life, not your surgeon's life, not your doctor's life. This is your life. Don't you want to go into this as prepared as you possibly can be? And we really see this when it comes to chemotherapy. There's so many options now and so many alternatives. Cancer treatment has come a long way. And a lot of people, they won't ask, they won't discuss it. And rather than taking a real butt-kicking drug, they avoid the discussion. And sometimes, I mean, I just had a friend, she passed away from a recurrent 20-year later recurrence of breast cancer, and she couldn't take the chemo. It was too much for her, and she actually wound up dealing without having medical intervention. And I want to be honest with you, people very often can live longer without the intervention. I had a gentleman, this is many years ago.
Before you go further, your website again for people.
It's wholehealtheducation.com, and we have some freebies. We have free patient advocacy. We've got free information and free things you can access to help you with this. And what I was trying to tell you is I had a house painter. I'm going back maybe 25 years. His name was Alfie, and he was really good, but he was a smoker and he was a house painter. And needless to say, his lungs, had taken a beating. And he found out he had lung cancer. But what he thought was bad news was that he had inoperable lung cancer. They wouldn't touch him, they wouldn't put him under the knife because of the complication of where it was. And if he had had regular lung cancer, okay, his prognosis would have been 2 to 3 years. The man lived 8 years longer, not having any medical care. So What I'm trying to share here is that you, if you're well versed, if you understand, if you do your research, if you understand what you're bringing to the doctor, you're going to have a much better experience and a much better chance. I don't know if you remember this. You're old enough to remember this, Don. Do you remember back in the 80s in New York City, there was a huge hospital strike? The hospitals, the doctors, everybody went on strike. And you couldn't get care for anything. And the strike went on for about a month or so. Do you know that the death rate went down? The death rate, do you remember? The death rate went down. What does that tell you? It tells you that, look, we're taking our chances. We're all taking our chances. And I'm not, look, I've been in healthcare and medicine for decades. No one loved and admired good medicine more than me. I think when you're looking at really brilliant medicine, when you're looking at doctors and nurses who are practicing on a very high level, there's nothing more beautiful than to see that. Especially when you see some of the issues that are resolved and some of the outcomes. But I think what has happened, and I can tell you the story. Insurance has taken over the practice of medicine.
No kidding.
Okay. It has taken over. And I'm going to tell you why I think your listeners might enjoy knowing how this happened. Back in the 70s and late 60s and 70s, there was excess, enormous amounts of unnecessary surgery. I mean, enormous. 66% of all hysterectomies were not necessary. And so you had doctors, they wanted a new boat, they wanted a new car, they'd order up a half a dozen surgeries. And the insurance companies who were paying for all of this, they said, look, this is wrong. And if you don't start policing yourself, we're going to take over healthcare. We're going to take over the supervision of what's going on with healthcare. We're going to look at procedures. We're going to look at prescriptions. We're going to look at what you're doing. And they warned the doctors. The doctors didn't listen. They kept doing what they were doing. And the insurance company said, we've had enough. They were spending billions of dollars on unnecessary procedures. So what happened was the insurance companies came in, and you have to know what is the bottom line of an insurance company? The bottom line is the dollar. The bottom line is how much are we going to make? So what happened there was the insurance companies took over and they became the watchdogs. They watched what was going on, they counted the surgeries, and they set the regulations and they set the prices for different procedures. And we all know that the insurance companies are looking out for number one. And we had that terrible tragedy, that terrible situation where that young man who had he had had a very bad surgery and a very bad outcome as a result of it. He went and unfortunately murdered the CEO of one of the large insurance companies. Insurance companies, they're no saints, okay? They deny care. They withhold care where the doctors were, handing it out like M&Ms, the surgeries and the care. So I don't think that people understand that when you're stepping out into medical care, you've got to know what you're doing and you've got to know what they're doing.
Well, someone once told me that 33 cents of every dollar in involves paperwork rather than actual delivery of any sort of service in the healthcare industry. And it's truly amazing. And I've been going through it for the last year anyway. So before we go further again, your website, please.
Whole health education dot com. And it's kind of is another you can also get in another way, but wholehealtheducation.com, and you'll see it. And if you go into that website, when you open it up, what it says, there's a picture of an ambulance and a young person being put in it, a young woman, and these two, professionals are getting her in the ambulance. And then the next scene, they're driving her away. And we say one out of, the third leading cause of death. And the third leading cause of death in the United States is not a disease, Don. It's not a disease. It's medical error. Okay. And that's the leading cause of death. Can you imagine all the error that's going on?
Well, I can because when I went this summer when I had surgery, they kept asking me which leg was involved. I must have asked me 20 times between my room and the time I actually went into the operating room. I mean, how many times did you tell me it's the left leg? But they kept asking me, and I guess
You know what the,
it,
you know what they do now? They put marker. They'll take a they'll put a marker on it.
They don't even believe that anymore. They ask you again, well, which leg is it? What's your name? Oh, and that other one, what's your date of birth? I never said it so many times in my life,
And you know what that proves? People are not paying attention. If you're paying attention, do you have to ask a patient 20 times? You can't write it down. You can't remember that. See, in the old days, I was lucky. I mean, I'm almost 80 years old, and I had a family doctor that came to the house. We had, old-time medicine. And in those days, doctors were paying attention to you. They didn't have to ask 20 times, where does it hurt? They knew where it hurt because they were listening and they were looking. Today, everyone is distracted. I was reading an article about this one young doctor. It was a whole article they did on him in one of the journals. And do you know what the most rewarding thing for him was? The most rewarding thing for him was waiting for the Blue Cross Blue Shield checks that came in from his practice. And he admitted it. It's one thing to say, gee, I'm just in this for the money. And the other thing to say, you know what makes me happy is when I see those checks coming in the mail.
That's true. We unfortunately have just a couple of minutes left. First, your website again for people.
WholeHealthEducation.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in the last 2 minutes, what would you like to leave our audience with?
If you have any kind of concern, any health issue that you want to work on, and I don't care if it's plastic surgery, you need to know what to expect. You need to know what the procedures are. You need to know about the doctor. You need to be able to ask questions, and you need to be well informed. My advice to everyone, there are plenty of advocates out there. Hire yourself a health advocate. It makes all the difference in the world. They're not expensive, Hire yourself a health advocate because when you walk in with a health advocate, that doctor knows there's more eyes on him or her than with you just walking in. So protect yourself, look out for yourself, please take care of yourself. We live in a very, unfortunately, a trepidous world today. Our world is very scary. So please take care of yourself. And I hope none of you become a statistic. None of you want to be a statistic.
Or in my case, have a great wife. But you're absolutely right. The difference between having somebody that looks out after you, whether it's in the hospital, in a rehab, wherever, is so definitely important. And Georgiana, thank you for your efforts. It's really been a pleasure, and I'm glad we took the time to hear you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for allowing a different subject into your, into your What do you call it? I can't even remember, but thank you for embracing a different subject.
It shows.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes, hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. For family, long a center of his life was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with their mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore.
Don Mazzella here again for Small Business Digest. A couple of weeks ago, we went up to New Hampshire. I have to admit, my wife, Joanne Lang, went to Harvard Business School with Carolyn's husband. And they have a wonderful event every year where we get together and pick apples. And it's absolutely terrific. But then again, the night before, we came to Carolyn's cheese shop. And it's more than a cheese shop. And I said, you know, you have to be on my program. And she said, okay. And Carolyn Shaw is with us today. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Don. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, how I appreciated being at your cheese shop. It was really an experience. And I said, let's talk about it. Carolyn, first, as we ask every guest, tell us a little bit about your personal background.
Well, I grew up in New Jersey. And when I was a freshman in high school, my parents moved to Europe. So we lived in England for 2 years, and then I finished my high school up in Switzerland. And then I went to college at Keene State in Keene, New Hampshire.
So you ended up in New Hampshire. You know, it's a great state. I was really surprised. We ourselves moved from New Jersey Wilmington, Delaware, but it was great. But now, having said that, you've created a, well, not created, you've expanded a cheese shop. But what made you go into it?
Well, I think having the opportunity to grow up in Europe, it really opened up so many channels for me as a kid. You know, my parents were always into exploring where we lived and the communities that we were surrounded by. So living in England and living in Switzerland, you know, cheese makers were a thing, right? So we would go and we would explore these beautiful farms and we would get exposure to really cool cultures that, you know, I didn't necessarily have the experience and learning about when I lived in New Jersey. So having an amazing experience where on a Thursday afternoon, a huge truck would pull up in front of our house in Switzerland and the back door would open up and the aromas of fresh bread and cheese and meats, butter would just come wafting out of the back of this truck. And you can't help but think, wow. What an immersive, amazing experience just to be around all this great food. So, when I went to college, I was looking for a part-time job. And at the Colony Mill Marketplace, there was a cheese store that opened up. So, I felt like I had had some experience from living in Europe and being able to eat these amazing foods over there. I could translate that to, you know, helping them out at the shop. And it was great. And you know, I think I've always had a little bit of a cheesy background, you know, exploring and wanting to learn more and being around people that just enjoy food.
Well, before we go further, the first question is, where's your cheese shop?
So
And go
the
ahead.
cheese shop is located in Hampton, New Hampshire.
And what's his name?
It's Say Cheese, C apostrophe EST cheese. It's a play on words.
Okay. And do you have a website?
I do. It is www.saycheesenh.com. You have
Okay,
to put the NH in there because there's a Say Cheese in New Zealand, there's a Say Cheese in California, there's one in New Jersey. So the NH is pretty important.
so now, having said that, all right, how did you end up in New Hampshire? Ended up with this particular shop?
Well, in the mid-2000s, I found myself in a spot for a career change. I was a single mom raising my two kids. I had a great job, but I wanted to have another supplementary income that I could have some fun, learn something, and meet some great people. And that led me to working at the second location of Say Cheese when it was down the street in Northampton. I had bumped into the owner and asked her if she was hiring. And she said, well, maybe come in and talk to me. So we had a conversation. And the next day, I sent her a thank you note, appreciating the time that she took. And 2 days later, she called me up and said I was hired. So I had worked for the original owner for 7 years. And it was great. I loved the people. I loved the experience. It really lends a creative side because we do a lot of charcuterie boards. We do a lot of personal, you know, catering and events and parties, and it's really amazing.
Well, I always ask this question of entrepreneurs. What makes you do the leap? I mean, it's difficult. You're buying a business and you're jumping in. What made you decide you wanted to do it?
I love coming to work every day. You know, and if you get the opportunity to find something that, you know, fills your joy, you know, fills a niche within the community that people need. If I have something that I can give that somebody else is looking for and it makes them happy and it makes their lives easier, for me, I was just drawn to that. I was just drawn to what this looks like in our community. And I love it. I just absolutely love it. I come to work surrounded by amazing people. There's wonderful customers. It's just joy.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the unique selling point, which is a Harvard Business School idea. But what makes a cheese company, a cheese store successful? I mean, I've seen cheese stores come in and go out quickly. What do you do that makes you successful?
Well, I would say, Don, more than selling cheese or wine or crackers, we sell customer service. You know, the customer comes in and we just want to make it the best experience for them possible. We do realize that it's a specialty cheese shop. The fact that you might not have ever traveled or you don't really have the experiences of what those cheeses are. When you come in, we diffuse that. It's a very real and a very user-friendly atmosphere. We're a tasting store, so we don't ever want anybody to go home with a bad surprise. So when you come in and you don't know what you're looking for, but you know maybe you want to have a cheese plate because you have friends coming over that you haven't seen in 10 years, or you know you're having an event for your daughter and she wanted to have a cheese platter, but you don't know anything about cheese. We walk you through the process and we explore with you the flavors. We talk to you about, you know, what you're experiencing, if you like what you're tasting, if you don't like what you're tasting. So I really feel like customer service really not so much sets us apart, but I think it makes us unique because it is a one-on-one experience every time people come in.
Well, it was certainly when the case when we were there. I mean, that was a cheese plate. But having said that, our Americans are different in many different ways. But are they different in terms of what they like in cheese?
I don't think they're really different. I think the exposure when you're in Europe is a little bit greater on how many varieties there are and different types. Unfortunately, here in the United States, we notice that most people's experience is from the grocery store. So a lot of people ask for smoked Gouda or Havarti, and those are not necessarily things that we have. Because our world's a little bit more open with variety, because we do source from the entire world.
Well, let's talk about that. How do you find your cheeses?
So a lot of times we get customer suggestions, whether they've traveled to Portugal or they've gone, you know, to Spain or they've gone to France and they've tried these cheeses that are amazing. A lot of times they bring back suggestions and we find those.
So you do get customer suggestions.
Oh, a lot of customer suggestions. I mean, we wouldn't be here without our customers. So if we can source things for them that they would like to try and share with their families, we're more than happy to do the homework to find those for people.
Well, to me, cheese always means cheese and good bread. Have you been able to find good bread in New Hampshire?
So we actually source from a company out of France where we have, you know, par baked bread, and we have it in our freezer, and you can bring it home and put it in the freezer for 12 minutes, and you just want to throw on a beret and grab a chunk of brie, and you just feel like you're transported.
Okay. Your website again for people who would like to learn more?
The website is Say Cheese NH. Dot com. Sorry about that.
No, can you spell it out for our audience?
Sure. It is CESTCHEESENH.com.
Okay. Well, let's go back. What are the one or two things, kind of obstacles that you've overcome over your first period?
Well, I think sometimes customer perception. You know, it is a store that is a unique store, I would say, because it's more of a boutique style atmosphere, people feel intimidated. So I think intimidation, whether it's I'm not dressed well enough to go there, or I'm not comfortable going there because I'm not knowledgeable enough about cheese, or, even unfortunately in this economy, the fear of what the tariffs have done to us as far as the prices. You know, those are some of the biggest obstacles.
How have you dealt with the tariffs?
Well, realizing that we are a luxury product, unless we have business, we don't belong here. We have the cheese store itself. When we have moved to our new location here in Hampton, we sort of evolved and expanded. We did add a wine bar, which has been a great addition. So we can share, our recipes with people, some of the things that we've discovered in our travels around the world. And we can share that with our customers. So we do have a wine bar with lunch and dinner. We also have an event room. So we've added to the cheese piece, which is really helpful, I think, in kind of diffusing the pressure of when you come in here and feeling like there's a spotlight on you. With the tariffs, we realize that, you know what? For me, and in the future, it might be tricky, but I will never go over $40 for a pound of cheese. It's a lot of money. And when people come in and they see those prices, they panic. But a pound is a lot of cheese. Not a lot of people buy a pound of cheese. And when you go to a supermarket and you see a small chunk and it might have $12 on it, and that seems manageable. In fact, we've done some price comparison. We're actually cheaper than our local grocery stores. But because we offer it by the pound, it seems like it's a little bit more. But we're competitive, if not better.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about the price point of $40.
Yeah. It can be very intimidating, but you know what? A pound of cheese is a lot of cheese. And I would say it's rare for anybody to walk out with that. Do most people go walk out with a quarter of a pound? Sure. But the average price of our cheeses is around $30 a pound. So you're walking out with a quarter of a pound of cheese, you've spent $7. That's not very intimidating.
No.
That's a coffee at a well-known coffee shop.
Yes. Well, let me ask you this question. You're in a shopping center like area. Do you think it's better to be in a shopping area or by yourself in a separate house or something?
Well, I think in our other location, we were one little yellow house that the cheese stood alone on the street. It was cute, it was adorable, and it was standout. But you know what? I think for what it was at the time, it was great. But we've moved to a plaza, as you mentioned, and I think it's like anything. We're in a community. And I think when you're a part of a community, it's just a richer experience. We get to feed off of each other. Where someone goes to the health food store next door and they happen to walk by and have never heard of us, and they come in and they explore, and we get to feed off each other. We have a wonderful spa a couple doors down. We've got a thrift shop for ladies' clothing right next to us. We've got a pizza shop. We all work off of each other. It's an amazing community. I think we're all thriving with the plaza being full, and it's terrific. Plenty of parking, easier to get in. It's great.
The town itself that you're in, what's it like, and what would you suggest? What type of a town would you suggest for a cheese shop like yours?
Well, it's interesting because we live in a coastal town in New Hampshire, which is driven by, tourism. So anywhere from the beginning of June to the end of August, boy, we're crazy with people coming to the beach. But then when August dies down and September, October, November roll around, we get the leaf peepers. So we get a lot of people flowing in that way. And then it's ski season. Who doesn't want to come in and get cheese for fondue? We're so fortunate with where we are and the town. where it's located in the state of New Hampshire, it's one of the most perfect spots to be because we have people that entertain in big, beautiful parties, and we have people that grab a basket of cheese and go up to the mountains for a weekend.
Hmm.
So, grab a couple sandwiches, you go to the beach. We couldn't be in a more perfect spot, Don. It's fabulous.
Do you see creating a satellite store someplace else sometime in the future?
Well, I don't think you can ever say never.
Well, you know, people say you have to expand or die, but about overcoming obstacles. Well, what has been a real advantage to you in your initial period?
Well, the advantages. I've surrounded myself by an amazing staff, which is a support system that has the same beliefs that I do. We are strong in the community with our ties. We can help extract from people, you know, what they're looking for, kind of hold their hand to get them, you know, to be able to get to the end of a journey that makes them happy, with being able to share what they've learned from us with their friends, their family, and other people that they meet. So I think it's surrounding yourself with good people. And I have an amazing staff. I've got an amazing chef. I've got an amazing bartender. And we're all about being here and being a positive spot in our community.
I'm trying to think about my own experience there. Let's talk about the bar and the dining. What made you decide to go into that?
Well, the little house that we were in before was great. You know, as far as selling cheese and selling wine, we had really gotten to our limit of our earning potential there. Mm-hmm. It was a small building. It was 1,200 square feet, and we had maximized our capacity. So we had come to the end of our lease. We had come to an end of the agreement with the original owner's husband because she had passed away. And when she passed away, she had offered for me and my old business mate to buy it, and we did. But at the end of our 2-year contract, you know, the building was being sold, and we had to figure out what we're going to do. And my partner decided to retire. That we had, you know, lived our dream for 2 years, and it was what we had needed it to be. And she had some other obligations she wanted to, you know, fulfill with her life and other dreams. And I thought, you know what, maybe I'll retire too. I just got married. It's a good opportunity. It's a perfect break. But when I saw this location and I started thinking, you know, in 2 years, we sold $28,000 in gift certificates.
Wow.
We've got a community that adores us. Where are we going? I can't close. I mean, what a horrible loss that would be. So I thought, you know what, go big or go home. I went back and I looked at all my notes, what people wanted. They wanted a bigger store that was safer to get into. They wanted easy parking. They wanted it to be easily accessible if you had a handicap. They wanted a function room. They wanted to be able to have a European dining experience and be able to sit with a glass of wine and chat with their friends in a unique spot. So I put all of that together. And in 6 weeks, we opened this. Mm-hmm. And no short of a miracle, Don.
Well, let's talk about research for a minute. You decided to ask your customers what they wanted?
Yes, 100%. We wouldn't be here without them.
Mm. And you're selling gift certificates. People say it's a great thing or it's a terrible thing. But obviously, you think gift certificates are good, or
they've been wonderful for us. You know, it gives somebody the opportunity and a reason to maybe go out of their comfort zone. And I know it sounds silly that cheese would be super intimidating, but people often come in and say, "Gosh, I'm so stupid. I don't know anything." And we think, "Wow, that We didn't either when we started. So let's learn together. Like let's help you kind of figure out what you like, what you don't like, and we can narrow it down. And I think the gift certificate is almost like a hall pass for someone to be able to try something that they necessarily wouldn't have done on their own.
What is the one thing that you've learned from all of this that you'd pass on to our audience?
I think retail is a long game. It's like anything you plant. You put a seed in the ground and it has to grow roots. And once you've grown your roots, then the flowers start to come. It's the long game. You're not going to get into a retail business and all of a sudden be like, these are my dreams. This is going to happen. I'm going to be rich. Your riches come in different ways. Your riches come in the beginning in the sales that you make to someone that you necessarily, wouldn't have really come across before. It's the small, tiny connections that we make with people in the community for our type of business. The woman whose husband that just died and has nowhere to go, and she finds herself sitting in our cafe, remembering the trip that she went to with her husband in France when she was 25. We get to give that to people. So it's the long game. It's knowing that whatever you do today, they're ripples that are, you don't even know that you're making. And it's an honor to be able to be in a business in a community like we're at. It's an honor.
Oh, that's a great one. Your website, if one last time.
The website is saycheesenh.com. And if you go onto our top page, it'll bring you to our story. And everything that I talked to you about today is in there. And I hope people enjoy that. And I think the one thing with our website, when you do look, because a lot of people will look on their phones, Don, instead of looking on the computer, there's a menu that it looks like there's only four items, but just keep scrolling because you'll find everything you're looking for.
Well, you have 1 minute. What would you like to leave our audience with?
Thank you so much for the opportunity for having me on here, just to be able to share, my story, to share that, food shouldn't be intimidating. It's just a wonderful way to invite people in. It's a great way to gift to somebody, to maybe just show some appreciation in a different way. I just can't say enough of what a fabulous experience this is. Whether we succeed or we fail, the process has been amazing. And I would like to think that in this economy, with the customer service that we provide, and we're giving something to somebody that's a little bit more special than they might get someplace else, and makes them want to come back.
Well, on that note, we say thank you, Carol, for a really great time together.
Well, thank you, Don. I'm so grateful.
One, the Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone. In my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. We recall his mother actually Tony Soprano's mother actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.